morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. You all have been here before. We have six cases on our docket this morning, but only three for oral argument, and the two scheduled for 9 o'clock are Acevedo versus State and McAllister versus Hatbreeze Properties. And I see the lawyers are here for Acevedo, and I'll ask Megan Polk, our Chief Deputy Clerk, to call the case.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ms. Mazerly. A week ago, a Marine by the name of Dakota Myers was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. And I'll quote briefly from President Obama's speech that he gave before presenting that medal. He said, "Let me tell you a story. I want you to imagine it's September 8th, 2009, just before dawn. A patrol of Afghan soldiers and their American trainers is on foot, making their way into a valley leading to a village to meet with elders. And that's when it happens. About a mile away, Dakota, who was then a corporal, and his sergeant could hear the ambush over the radio. It was as if the whole valley was exploding. Taliban fighters were unleashing a firestorm from the hills, from the stone houses, even from the local school. And four Americans, Dakota's friends, were surrounded. Four times Dakota asked for permission to go in. Four times they were told it was too dangerous, and they did not get permission, and they disobeyed orders, and they did go in. The story of what Dakota did will be told for generations," President Obama said. He also noted that Dakota's courage and steadfast devotion to his U.S. and Afghan comrades in the face of almost certain death reflect a great credit upon himself and upheld the greatest traditions of the Marine Corps and the United States Naval Service. Judges, I submit to you that something very similar could have been written about the appellant, Eric Acevedo. He was in Fallujah, Iraq, during the worst part of that war. He developed post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that. Not only did he lead constant patrols into battle, and these were just teenagers that were his, at trial they testified they were his brothers, and they looked up to him. And his best friend, his best brother over there, was another Marine. They would patrol with Humvees. This other Marine was about a mile away in his Humvee with other members of the platoon. Mr. Acevedo was on patrol about a mile away at another, stationed at another intersection, when a battle broke out. The Humvee that his friend was in took incredible fire from enemy forces. Eric had just seen him filling up his Humvee, his friend, at a station. And unfortunately, Humvees, like any other vehicle, if they're hit in the right spot, burn. And they burn with incredible incredible amount of force and incredible amount of fire. Well, his friend, his brother's Humvee was hit. And like Dakota, who won the Medal of Honor, the radio was on, and his friends were calling for help. Like Dakota, they requested permission to go in, and they were denied. They were ordered it was too dangerous. And Mr. Acevedo was physically restrained from going in. Sorry if I get emotional about this. I got very emotional in the trial. His best friend burned to death, and he could hear the screams over the radio. Other members of the platoon took that death very hard. Eric took it incredibly hard. They all resulted, and they were all underage, they're all under 21, but they resulted to drinking, to try to self-medicate. And when they got back to the States after their discharge, and this is in the testimony, they did testify on Eric's behalf at trial. Some of them, with the help of their family, beat the drinking problem. Eric, they said, had PTSD the worst. And this post-traumatic stress disorder is now just recently coming to full light as far as a mental condition. It's existed forever. In War One, we called it battle fatigue. There were other names for it too. And it's been there forever. I mean, if you go back in the Bible and read the Battle of Jericho after the walls came tumbling down, the part that isn't normally read in churches is what happened afterwards. According to the Bible, God ordered that all of the people living in Jericho, including the children and the animals, be massacred, completely exterminated by the Jews. And the Israelite army did that. And there's a reference to what happened to them afterwards. They had to take, God told them allegedly, several days off to purify themselves with water. And a lot of people think the entire Israeli army had post-traumatic stress disorder. So, you know, sometimes we call it shell shock, sometimes we call it battle fatigue, but post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder. And there is no doubt but that Eric Acevedo had that disorder when he returned to the States after he was Marine. Now, while he was in Fallujah, he had a girlfriend back in the States. She was an older than him, but she was his girlfriend, and he loved her, and her name was Molly Ward. He sent her almost every dime he made. His buddies testified that when they got discharged, they came back, and they were given some discharge, $15,000, $20,000, and they came down to see Eric because they were all like brothers. And one of them mentioned, Eric, let's go to Taco Bell. Eric didn't have any money to go to Taco Bell. So they lent him money. He had given all of his money to Molly Warden. Now, Molly Warden, at some point, developed an addiction to methamphetamine. And at some point, she began dancing in order to support herself. She needed money in addition to what he was giving her. He didn't like that. He hated that. When they came back, they had an off and on relationship. The police were often called. She recognized that he had post-traumatic stress disorder because on one occasion she actually took him to the VA's hospital. It's just they weren't getting the treatment that he needed. But they also had this terrible relationship. You know, who were not meant for each other. He needed a different woman, and she needed a different man. And one of the things that she would do would be to text message him. And they're in the record. Some of the worst insults you could ever imagine. One of those insults, right before the event that led to her death, and I'll talk about that in just a second. I'm not trying to escape the facts of this case, because they're awful. She sent him a text saying he was a coward, that he couldn't even save his friend. He was doing terrible things to her. I mean, their text messages that she sent him were absolutely incredible. And for someone with PTSD, it was like throwing gasoline on fire. And things built. And she called the police on him multiple times there at the apartment. It was an apartment that he paid for, that she lived in, and that he actually was on the lease. But we attempted a defense at trial that you can't burglarize your own apartment, because he apparently kicked the window in and went in and stabbed her to death and then stomped her face in. And what makes this even worse is that there is a 911 phone call that captures everything, captures her death, because she was calling 911. You can hear the knife go in multiple times. You can hear him grunting. You can hear her face being caved in with his boots. He was charged with capital murder. They did waive the death penalty. But the only option in that situation, if he's convicted, is life without parole. And that's what he received. Now, getting to the point of the appeal. Mr. Acevedo, under the law, Court of Criminal Appeals present law, was permitted to introduce evidence in front of the jury that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. But what he was not able to do, the judge prohibited him from doing, Judge Wish, and under the law, Judge Wish was correct, because the Court of Criminal Appeals says this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to let in any evidence of post-traumatic stress disorder. But what you can't do is allege that his mental capacity was diminished because of it. And that is because, under Texas law, diminished mental capacity is not a defense. So you don't get to introduce evidence on that. You don't get to ask for a jury instruction on that. So what that means is, in capital cases, unless you have evidence that the defendant was insane, and the psychologist said, no, he wasn't insane, he just had a diminished mental capacity while he committed this terrible act. And as some evidence of that, even the state's evidence, they had a next-door neighbor that lived next door. The next-door neighbor walked by the window and turned to the left and looked in and saw the defendant on top of Molly stabbing her, repeatedly stabbing her. And the door was open. And the defendant said, looked up at John, his neighbor, and said, "Oh, hi, John." John said, "That's Molly." "Eric?" And he kept on stabbing. And John went and called for help. The police arrived. They didn't find, and I think there's insinuation in the state's brief that the defendant was about to flee. No, he didn't. He was found wandering in the parking lot, dripping blood. And there were blood trails all over the parking lot where he was wandering around, dripping blood. Under current Texas law, Judge Wish's ruling was correct. What I am asking this court to do is something simple, and that is to say diminished mental capacity should be recognized as a defense in Texas in capital murder cases. Because these jurors, no matter how bad they wanted to use that evidence, had no mechanism under Texas law. They had to find him guilty. There was no defense. Diminished mental capacity is not a defense. This evidence did come in.
Was there a jury instruction given regarding this evidence at all?
No, Judge, because we couldn't. We previewed the evidence in front of the jury without the jury being present. And that's when Judge Wisch said, you can get it all in, but you can't get this stuff in about diminished mental capacity, because that's not recognized in Texas, as I'm not going to permit it. So therefore, we had no basis on which to request a jury instruction on it. Now, what this amounts to is if the judge said, you can take a drink of water, but don't swallow. Diminished mental capacity is PTSD. PTSD is diminished mental capacity. And yet the jurors were not allowed to hear evidence of the diminished mental capacity, which is a diagnosis that is made from the PTSD, because the judge wouldn't permit it, because Mays and Jackson don't permit it. But I'll tell you one thing that separates this from those cases. We've got a record in this case. They found reasons in both of those cases to say a record wasn't developed. They didn't argue this in the trial court. We've got a record here that was not present in Mays and is not present in Jackson. And again, what we're asking this court to do is not to find in our favor, because I think you have to follow Mays and you have to follow Jackson. But please, we're asking this court to put some indication in there that perhaps the Court of Criminal Appeals should take another look at a case where this is perfected in the record. It's an absolutely horrible case, and you will have nightmares if you listen to the 911 phone call. Absolutely horrible case. And the only thing separating Eric Acevedo, I submit, from Dakota Myers is a very thin line. A person who had post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the horrible things that he saw in Fallujah and horrible things he heard when his friend died. And the fact that they restrained him from going in to help those guys.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mr. Richards. The state we agree with Mr. Richards' characterization of the law. I mean, he's right. Right now, there is no diminished capacity defense in Texas. However, as David mentioned, evidence of this post-traumatic stress disorder is admissible in trial, and it was admissible in this court, and it was admitted. If you look at Volume 9 of the record, I think almost that entire volume is the expert witness testifying as to the defendant's post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a lot of testimony on that. Mr. Richards was also able to argue to the jury that the defendant had this post-traumatic stress disorder, and because of that, and if you look specifically at his argument, he said he did not have the intent. He didn't have the intent to murder this woman. So he was able to argue that to the jurors, despite the fact that he did not have that jury instruction. And I don't recall that he actually asked for the jury instruction. I know that's not pointed out in the brief, and I apologize for that. I didn't author the brief. I agree with the brief, and I support it. It's just that's something that I probably would have included as well. This case that David was talking about, and I believe it very much is on point, Jackson v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals, 2005. I think if you look back again at this case, which I'm sure you probably already have, this case is very similar. In that case, a young man, I'm not sure if he killed his brother or if he just beat him very severely, but he introduced evidence that he had had some mental problems in his past. It wasn't post-traumatic stress disorder, but he had struggled I think all his life was some mental problems. His mother was allowed to testify. His brother was allowed to testify. I think he actually testified himself, as Mr. Acevedo did in this case, as to what he was thinking that night, what his frame of mind was. And the trial court allowed that evidence to come in. Now, as in this case, they didn't allow it to come in order to say that he was incapable of developing an intent. That you can't do. But he was allowed to introduce that evidence to negate the intent, the mens rea. And that's the law as it is currently, as Mr. Richards says. And that was present in this case. I don't know what other evidence could have been introduced. I mean, as I said, Mr. Richards was allowed to argue that he did not have that intent. I think the only thing missing was a jury instruction. But I don't think Mr. Richards asked for it. And again, in this case, as in the Jackson case, the jurors heard all this evidence of Mr. Acevedo's post-traumatic stress disorder, how that had affected him, and they were the judges of the credibility of the evidence, and they found that the state had proved that he did have the intent to kill Molly. I'd also just like to address something. I know if you can just indulge me for a moment, I understand that this is not directly related to this issue, but as the prosecutor and as a representative of the state and the victim in this case, I just want to point out a couple of things. I just feel that this is necessary based on what Mr. Richard said. Molly was older than Mr. Acevedo. He did send her money during the time that he was stationed in Iraq. But at the time that she was killed, they were separated. She wasn't dancing. She wasn't a stripper anymore. She was working at Love Field. She was actually a member of a church. She was supposed to get baptized on the very day that she was brutally stabbed to death by the defendant. Her rent was $35 behind in arrears. So if he was giving her money, I don't know where it was, because her rent was very much behind. There was evidence, and we don't know, but there's evidence that he raped her. The evidence in the record reflects that she was trying to separate from this man. And yes, she did send him some very not nice emails. But he was calling her, and the evidence shows that he was harassing her. She referred to him as her stalker. He called her 48 times on the day that he killed her. And she's dead. She was stabbed to death 11 times. Every single stab wound, the coroner said, was fatal. You know, I don't think it's good to send mean email messages. I'm not trying to say it's okay, but she's dead. He's alive. I just wanted to point that out. If the court doesn't have any questions for me, the state will just stand on its brief, and that we ask that you affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor. I didn't ask for a jury instruction because Judge Wish did not let in evidence of diminished mental capacity. He specifically told us we could not bring in evidence of diminished mental capacity because of the PTSD. And that was a major issue in the case. And not only did he reiterate that to us, he reiterated it time and time again when our expert testified outside the presence of the jury. He said, you can go in there and present his testimony about the PTSD and how that affected his mind, but you are not allowed to suggest that at the time that he killed her, it was a diminished mental capacity. When I was arguing this case in front of the jury argument, what did I get? I got an objection, and you know what? The objection was proper, because I was asking for what was in effect a jury nullification on this. And the prosecutor said, objection, Your Honor, he's asking for jury nullification. And it was, because that is the law. The law is you can drink, but you can't swallow. You can put on PTSD, but you can't put on evidence of what, in effect, that means and how it applies under Texas law. If you can't get the mental state to insanity, we have a tough definition of insanity, and our expert said, no, he wasn't insane. But, Judge, he was operating under a diminished mental capacity because of his post-traumatic stress disorder. And the judge said, you cannot tell the jury that. And because he could not tell the jury that, it would have been useless to ask for an instruction on post-traumatic stress disorder, because they did not know, the jurors were not ever told under the testimony that it involved diminished mental capacity. The last thing I'll point out, yes, there is not evidence that he raped her. She wrote some nasty emails to him, or text messages to him. He came back and said, no, I didn't. And then her text messages were absolutely incredible. And they're into evidence. And she was pointed, and it was obvious she was trying to hurt him. Yes, they had broken up, but they'd gotten back together, broken up, gotten back together. And the evidence showed she even had left him a phone message from earlier in the day saying, oh, I went out to the house you're moving into, the house you bought. And I went out and I looked at the garden. I looked in the garden. So this wasn't a situation where they were separated forever. It was the rebound by people that were completely incompatible. And I'll finish just by pointing out one of the things that I think demonstrated the post-traumatic stress disorder is after he was told she was dead, that he had killed her, he asked the doctor, okay, was it okay if I go in and talk to her? The jury couldn't do anything with that evidence in the case. Capital murder cases in Texas, if you're guilty of the act, this evidence does not come in as mitigation of punishment. I mean, if this was if he had robbed a bar and was charged with robbery, yes, the PTSD would come in as to mitigation and punishment. But in Texas, because of a quirk in our law, there are only two choices if you commit capital murder: death or life imprisonment. And it's life imprisonment without parole. And what do you tell jurors you talk to afterwards who may say, we wish we had some way of applying what we heard, but we didn't have that choice? PTSD was permitted into evidence. The judge allowed them to drink but not to swallow. We're asking that this court recommend to the Court of Criminal Appeals they take another look at this law, particularly in a situation where you have a hero, an otherwise hero like Mr. Acevedo, who committed one of the worst crimes you could ever imagine. Completely out of character, except as explained by post-traumatic stress and diminished mental capacity, a defense that Texas does not recognize. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Thank both of you. Excellent arguments by both counsel. And your case is submitted. You are excused.
Thank you.